pamphlet thing, was demonizing the UN and demonizing liberal churches for their stance on things, as if they weren't even legitimate because they disagreed with us conservative Christians. So lies of the right go way back. I mean, I'm sure they go back to the founding of this country. Lies of the conservatives. I guess what conservative really means is conserving the status quo. And when the status quo is never good, what's to conserve? It's like if conservative meant conserving the earth and not wasting things and not harming people unnecessarily and things like that, I'd be a conservative. But
That's really interesting. As I see things as being structural. And I think when you think of a structural issue, you know, I describe the white privilege, right? The privilege given by being white, you know, to other people in this country, is that for so you're seen as sort of neutral from the very first glance, blank, you know, like just something
right.
that, you know, you can just be who you are. People are going to wait to see what your personality is, what you are. But if you're a person of color, you have this mark against you. And you know, I think that I see white privilege as being the house that white supremacy built. So
right.
when I say structural, I mean that, you know, it's like being a mouse in a maze where you're being directed on which way to go. And so you come out the other end of the maze based on what it tells you to do, right? And so when you see that 90% of men who are white and who have a high school degree vote for Trump, right, in this incredibly high number, you have to realize that is in some ways, we often understand that as a moral failing, you know, on the left, the liberal left, or, you know, some sort of cognitive problem or just, you know, some sort of bigotry. But I think that it's a structural problem is what I'm saying. And because, I studied sociology in college, but to get this sort of vast number, you know, the sort of result that is almost 90%, 9 out of 10 people, you have to. There's a structural thing going on, and so my focus is going to be on the structure and how it operates in our society and in the world at large, because the United States makes decisions that impact everyone in the world, from not leading on climate change, and also, you know, kind of, you know, when Trump was not kind of giving a little wink to dictators, and so this harms people around the world, and so I think it's really important to look at what happened in Virginia, you know, during the early colonial period, when sort of the concept of race and anti-blackness and ideas about indigenous people and nations and their rights to land were really formulated, right? And this is what I call an origin story, and within that origin story is sort of a code, right? The algorithms of sort of what was going to happen. And so unless we adjust these algorithms and address the code, you know, it's going to be hard to make a change. And so it's because people are going to keep coming to the same conclusions, and we're going to persist in this standoff, right? And the standoff is aggressive towards each other, I think, particularly from white supremacy, which has historically used terrorism as a way to maintain power. Whether, you know, you see here in Oregon itself in the Constitution, you know, that was, you know, really very, very anti-black. You know, it was written into the Constitution and you know, threatened violence against black settlers, black, you know, families that wanted to come here. You know, and this was coming from the state itself, right? And you know, where my father is Dakota, and you know, in the state of Minnesota, had on, I think it still has on the books. They're not, you know, use it anymore, but you know, they have a price for our scalps. You know, that the state of Minnesota will pay for Dakota men and women, right, and children, even a price for a child's scalp. And you know, my cousin now serves in the Minnesota State Legislature, so obviously that's not active law. But the, you know, this is the threat, this constant threat of violence. And I should say that my grandfather was beaten to death by white police in South Dakota, just on the city next to our reservation. And, you know, and I know that violence really, you know, I could feel it in my family members when they, you know, they couldn't even talk about my grandfather because of the way he was murdered. And it's just, so that threat of violence, that sort of internal terrorism that exists within a colonial state, and one based on predicated on white supremacy. And I would say that white supremacy grew as a way to maintain order. And in Virginia, after the Bacon Rebellion, and when people stolen from Africa and held in bondage, and lower status planters from England, and also English indentured, British indentured servants. They all joined together to kind of fight the upper class, the establishment, the elite planters who controlled most of the best land, and they united together to rebel against them. And this was when really the concept of whiteness arose, because they found they could divide this sort of unified group by giving white indentured servants more rights than people they had that they were holding in bondage from Africa. And so it was, this is sort of a basis. This is like one of the, so this is like part of the origin story. This is the initial, this is one of the initial sort of, you know, algorithmic if then statements that are, it's creating the issues we see today. And so what I want to do in this series is to really analyze this systematically point by point, and then we can begin to sort of find other solutions based on that. And I believe that we need to find something that's sort of a new story in which how we relate to each other. And we can see that in some traditional contexts. My husband's people, he is Haudenosaunee, he's Mohawk and Seneca, Iroquois, from the Iroquois Confederacy, which once held New York State, right, upstate New York, was, you know, the Iroquois Confederacy for 1,000 years before, after the Revolutionary War, they took it over. And I make the argument that they fought the Revolutionary War to get access to Indian land. And so particularly in New York State and the Ohio River Valley. And but they have a wampum, which is called the two-row wampum, right? And the wampum, you know, they are these woven shell bands, and they were used as for treaties as well in the Northeast, and were very valuable. And so they made a two-row wampum, and it has two lines going side by side. And those two lines represent, one represents the colonists, and the other represents the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois Confederacy. And the idea was that these two canoes would go side by side, but not interfere with each other, right? And so this is the concept of an indigenous-based concept of how to relate to each other. And I will go into more detail about the fur trade as well. So anyway, sorry. Thank you for calling, though. I really appreciate it. And the role of Christianity, which I think I might discuss next, but yeah. Anyway, so thank you for our second caller, Jim. And I probably went way longer with the answer than he had expected. So, you know, just to briefly talk about the issue of the role of Christianity in creating these sorts of dynamics of oppression in this country historically. One of the main things that people, and I brought this up on Paul Rowland's show, Wednesday Talk Radio, before many times, is a legacy of the doctrine of discovery, right? And many of you probably have already heard about this. There are many mainline churches, including the Episcopal and Church, who have come out against the doctrine of discovery. They have a whole agenda to try to, you know, to get the United States to get rid of this doctrine. And this doctrine basically, states that it was formulated as a legal principle by one of the very first Supreme Court Chief Justices of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Marshall. And there is a series, you know, all federally recognized tribes and their citizens are all sort of covered under a federal law called Indian federal law, right, part of constitutional law. And that whole body of law applies to anyone who is a citizen of a federally recognized tribe and to the tribes themselves and the relationship to the United States. And so Chief Justice John Marshall, he oversaw three cases, which are considered the bedrock of Indian federal law. And he thought that these cases happened in the 1820s and 1830s. And so he was the Chief Justice of a brand new country, a country that did not have a lot of case law, right, obviously. And so he basically utilized sort of legal precedents from other parts of the world, including the Vatican, right? And granted, this country was not founded as a Catholic country. It was pretty much founded as primarily a Protestant country, you know. And so it seemed a little odd that they would be drawing upon Vatican law, but they did. And he found a couple of papal bulls, one from, like, I think 1492 and one from 1550 from two different popes. Popes issued these papal bulls, which are like legal pronouncements. And in these papal bulls, they basically, you know, declared that indigenous nations, discovered peoples, quote unquote, did not have title, fee simple title, which is a legal term to actual title of the land, because they only had the rights of animals, of use and occupancy, right? So the only group that did have legal title, right, are the European Christian discovering nations, right, the ones that were under the Pope when these papal bulls were issued. And so when they land, and they usually would land at sort of where the river emptied into the ocean, right, and they would claim the entire watershed, the whole water. And so they... So once they did that, then they would, put their little, read their pronouncement from their monarch, and then, tack up a little sign, and then they declare that all of the title to this land now had reverted to their monarch the minute they set their foot on the shore, and so this is actually the basis of U.S. title to our lands here in what is now called the United States, the homelands of hundreds of indigenous people, right, And so it's this is the basis of that claim. And it's still active law to this day, right? I mentioned earlier about not recognizing treaties, creating counties out of areas in that violation of international law, like Morton County, and then holding it through military means, which we really thought Standing Rock that was the military occupation of the Dakota and Lakota people's homeland made visible to the world, but it was not understood that way, obviously, by most people. But then you also have this other element, which is that, the U.S. is claiming this this right not as an indigenous nation, right? These aren't the homelands of the United States. They're claiming this right as a colony of England, because England existed when these papal bulls were passed and was still under the Pope at the time. And so they are claiming this land, title to this land, as a colony and as a Christian colony as well. And so it's very revealing about the dynamics of what's going on. And like I said, I think we should view each of these things as not merely an indictment of the moral authority of the colonial presence, but as actual... as actual sort of determining factors, right, of our situation today, how will they operate in our world today, and how can we change that, right? And of course, churches like the Episcopal Church, have been calling for the United States to refuse to acknowledge the Doctrine of Discovery anymore, which would undermine a lot of their claims, right, to the land itself, and force them to recognize the real title of Native nations to this land. And as I said, structural change, because this is a structural change, it would structurally change the political relationship between Native nations and the occupying U.S. government.
Barry's in the line.
We have another caller. Thank you so much. Hello?
Hello, this is Barry.
Hi,
Barry. Yes. Paul had a book on. I'm very sorry about your grandfather. I heard about that. I'm sorry. Paul had someone on his show. I've heard mentioned a lot of times structure. and then what we need to do about our government. Someone that had that wrote a book having to do with what we should do about our government, and should we do anything? Yes, certainly. But what's necessary to better our government? Do you know of that? Do you remember the name of the book?
Oh, I can't. I will ask Paul though, and I'm going to be putting together a page for the show, and I will after he tells me what it is, I will put it up on there as well. So would that be important?
Yeah, it was given away with a donation to cable or something like that after a while.
It might have been my book. I'm not sure. I did do that last month with him. So.
No, this other guy that was on.
Okay. Oh, good. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I will ask him. I think he mentioned that to me. I will, and I'd love to hear it as well. So.
Yes, we've got to do something about our government. It's crumbling. A question? Agreement?
Yeah. Oh, okay. No. I'm one of the reasons I'm doing this show is I am really very honestly nervous about what's going to happen. I don't think that things are naturally resolving themselves in a peaceful way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank
you.
Yeah. Okay. I will ask Paul.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I'd like to, let you know that you can call in. This is a call-in show. This is the show is called American Standoff with me, your host, Jacqueline Keeler. And we will be looking over the next 12 episodes at the issue of the political standoff in this country today and examining it through an indigenous perspective. And sort of what solutions can we find? How can we change the situation, change the standoff, right? And so you can call in here to KBOO at 503-231-8187. And I think we have a little over 12 minutes left. So, thank you so much for that call. And yeah, the reason I'm doing this is, I really want to, I am concerned about what the future holds. I actually didn't like really get excited about the new year because I really don't know what this year will hold. And so this is why we're having this conversation. I really do enjoy hearing people's perspectives and if you have books to suggest, that would be great. And I will definitely talk to Paul about that. Getting back to this, what Trump was doing with the gerrymandering, which, I think one of the things that I would like to also look at is what could happen if the Republicans take Congress, what's going to happen in the midterms, because a lot of what we see playing out right now is going to be deeply impacted by the activities going on. As I mentioned, Trump had worked to really suppress counting people of color, Black, Indigenous people of color in this country in the 2020 census, and that will have an impact for the next decade, right? So it's a way for them to hold back change, to prevent the voices of people who have not, of unrepresented people in this country to be heard, right, too. And so, despite these efforts, the 2020 census still shows in America that it's becoming less white, right? This is something that plays to the fears that Trump has exploited very successfully through his populist persona, and that was also articulated quite plainly in 2016 by the white supremacist marchers in Charlottesville, Virginia, who chanted "They will not replace us," that chant, of course, is referencing anti-Semitic language used in Nazi Germany. I think they even used the chant "blood and soil," which is something that was used by the Nazis. And this concept of blood and soil really speaks to the issue of white supremacy and of this ongoing colonial occupation of our land. This is a take on America that is not only nativist but also racist to its very core, and And so so this is why I'm doing this show, to try to, you know, articulate, you know, what this means, and maybe we can find some ways to, you know, I think that, I think thinking is really powerful. You know, one of my favorite Native authors is Paula Gunnell, and she's from Laguna Pueblo. And, you know, she talked often about, you know, in Pueblo culture, you know, she, the concept of thinking woman, of a woman who is thinking the world and being, right? And so, you know, and in Navajo way also, you know, our prayers are about how you think, how you approach things. You know, the prayers are not, I want this, I want that, necessarily, like the Christian prayers. They're more like, you know, as I am traveling through the world, this is happening. I mean, it's the language is very different too. So your relationship to things is different. I remember, you know, one of the examples I often tell is, you know, we often talk about when we put our pants on, right? We're taking our pants, we're putting them on us. That's our relationship to the world, sort of articulated that way in English. But in Navajo, you say, I sort of float myself through my pants. So it's like a different concept of your relationship to the world. And this is the real richness of indigenous cultures, right? And that is being lost in the languages, this perception, this very human, I see language and culture as being sources of human wealth in this world, not just resources or extractive industries. Or, you know, I see thinking, I see culture, I see our relationship to the earth itself as being the very source of human ingenuity, human wealth, human well-being, and for the in our relationship to everything in the world. So indigenous languages, the way they perceive the world, is really important, and it's also how their culture, how our cultures evolve, and the different social solutions, social ingenuity that Native nations bring to the table. And one of the things that I bring up often, in addition to the doctrine of discovery, is also and the treaty status of tribes. You know, the international sovereign status of Native nations is the issue of how modernism, the concept of American modernism that we bring around the world, how deeply it reflects indigenous culture and indigenous interaction. Right? You know, I mentioned the Iroquois Confederacy, which you know, stood for 1,000 years in upstate New York, and adjacent right there to Albany and to the colonies, right? And there was a lot of interaction that occurred between these two. The Iroquois Confederacy was 6 separate nations that spoke similar languages, but that had unified as a nation back about 1,000 years ago. And they often would speak to the colonists. And one of the famous was a Tadadaho who was a leader. The Tadadaho was the prime leader of the Confederacy, of their council, founding father Franklin. You know, he was actually hired. He was a printer, right? Benjamin Franklin was a printer there in Philadelphia, and he got the contract from Pennsylvania, when it was still a colony, to basically print the treaties that were being written and signed with the tribes. And so as part of that, he would also translate the speeches given by the Iroquois leaders. And so one of the speeches he printed was where the Tadadaho, I think his name was Conestego, was talking to the colonial leadership and telling them that they could unite all these colonies like the Iroquois Confederacy did. And so, you know, these concepts of democracy, of representative government, you know, they existed in Europe. I think, allegedly, Switzerland has a very long democratic tradition. But for the most part, they are not, you know, they are not at the forefront of European culture. At that point, European culture was based on a monarchy, on, you know, the... feudalism was still very much a ruling factor in the social organization of European countries, particularly in Great Britain. And so, you know, that was it's a really different social order. It's a social order that has built implicit ideas of what is right and what is wrong. You know, they saw the feudal order, where you have one man or one, usually one woman at the very top who owns everything, right? The only person who owned land in England was the King of England. You know, he was England, right? So you get this idea of real estate, where all the land belongs to the royal individual, right? And everyone else is a subject. Everyone else has no real rights to the land other than what's given to them by the king, the monarch. And even the lords and, you know, the nobility are given their rights via the monarch. And so it's this very top-down idea of relationship to the world. And it was seen as a reflection of what was going on in heaven, you know, that this is how heaven was ordered, with God at the top and everyone else below them. And you can see this in some of the religious iconography of the time, you know, the sort of like, here's how it is in heaven and here's how it is on earth, right? So it was actually your religious, moral imperative to obey the feudal order, right? And so this is what they brought here to the United States. And I see we're almost out of time. I will go on more about this later. But basically, you know, my point is that the Iroquois Confederacy and the interactions with indigenous governments is really what sort of gave these colonists, separated by the Atlantic Ocean, a different vision of themselves, right, and what is possible. And then also in Seneca Falls, New York, you know, it was folks like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, the first wave of feminists, they observed Seneca women reordering their government, and they began to feel like, well, you know, everything that's been told us about women being incapable, we see with our own eyes in real life, we see a community that's run completely differently, right? And in their speeches, they talk about that at Seneca Falls, you know, how, you know, they see Seneca women who are able to live their lives in ways that they can't, because they're white women who are legally dead at the time, white American women. And so it's this sort of inflection. So when we think of modernism, we think of going over to other countries and demanding these rights. We are, you know, democracy and women's rights. These are things that grew out of this cultural exchange with indigenous nations and are not endemic to European culture, per se. And so I will have to continue this, but I actually wanted to go out, and I don't mean to, once again, if this is triggering, please consider this a warning. You know, as I mentioned before, the House Committee has been examining the January 6th insurrection and, you know, issuing subpoenas, most famously just recently, Fox News guy. But they also, you know, we've had a lot of people who are facing prison time. And this particular excerpt deals with a Proud Boy, which, of course, we have had Proud Boys marching on our streets. And some of them were also went to Washington, D.C. a year ago. And so, and sadly, you'll see that, you know, the tools with which these folks have to wrestle with their decisions and the outcomes is problematic. And we'll continue to indicates that we will continue to have problems going into 2022, and I don't know how far or how badly those things will go. But I'm hoping for the best for 2022. So, but I am looking at very closely what's been going on. So, thank you so much, and I guess we'll go out with this, and I will be back next week as well, and we'll go more into the framework to understand what's happening. Thank you.
Police officers who responded to the January 6th attack, alleging Trump directed the assault that left them injured and traumatized. It comes as some of the people who rioted that day remain defiant, saying that they didn't do anything wrong and they have no regrets. Jessica Schneider is out front.
It's like, if you ask me if I do it again, I want to say yes, but then I question the back of my head, would I?
Former Proud Boy Josh Pruitt describes his past year as an emotional train wreck.
I don't feel like I did anything wrong, but knowing the consequences that came out of it would be the part that would make me question it.
Prosecutors have laid out an array of video as evidence against him. Pruitt can be seen confronting Capitol Police officers after walking in through the shattered front doors. And inside the Capitol crypt, Pruitt is caught smashing a sign. All of it leading to 8 federal charges against him, including counts for destruction of government property and acts of physical violence.